You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith and this is Eleanor Tiernan. She's a superb comic from Ireland that I first worked with in Dublin maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And her show was on the Free Fringe at Edinburgh this year, one of the many Free Fringes. And it was entitled Help the Frigid. It was one of my absolute favourites. So is she. This is Eleanor Tiernan.
Yeah, I really love talking about comedy. I don't get to have enough conversations about it, and an hour is, I think, is a good length of time to talk about comedy.
Why is that? Why don't you get to have many conversations about it?
Well, my friends aren't as interested or knowledgeable about it.
Do you not? Do you have friends in comedy?
I live in Dublin. I have loads of friends in comedy, but we just don't, I suppose, gig together that often. You know, some people are doing day jobs. I suppose you get to a stage when you're doing gigs where you're travelling with maybe newer comedians or on your own to gigs. And it's those journeys actually that are brilliant, I find, for... We've started, haven't we?
Yeah, we have started. Yeah. I was like, oh, she's calmed on. We've started. Yeah. No, we definitely have started.
Cool.
But so that's interesting because I don't know a huge amount about you or where you're from or what the scene is like in Dublin. I've gigged at the Laughter Lounge a few times. I love Dublin, love gigging there. But is it big enough? Is Ireland big enough to support comics who purely work in Ireland?
Occasionally, there's the odd comic that can. Say there's, looking at the scene, there's Tommy Tiernan who doesn't tend to do so much work outside. He's the one that does the most work in Ireland.
Gotcha.
And has a very big fan base. There's about 10 comics, I think, that can survive doing just stand-up. And then the rest of us do bits of writing and television, acting in things as well.
Okay.
You know.
Okay. Yeah. And you're... So does that mean that you're not on the same sort of circuit that you'd get over in the UK, for example? Obviously, I mean, how many times have you been over to the UK? Have I only ever seen you in...
Every time I've come to the UK.
Yeah, that's it. So I think of you, okay. Oh, she's here all the time, very cosmopolitan.
I suppose, what was the question?
Again? I'm just trying to get a sense of what the circuit is like in Dublin and whether, because we started from this point of view, it'd be nice, you like it when you talk about comedy. And I sort of feel like, obviously now when I do this, I talk about comedy to everyone all the time.
Yeah.
But there's a lot more car journeys with other comics maybe in my life than in yours.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I suppose the gig circuit is a little bit weak in Ireland. There's 5 big towns in Ireland, Dublin, Cork, Limerick, Galway and Belfast, and you can't gig there, you know, in those clubs as often as you'd like, you know, so and then there's gigs around Dublin, but yeah, you end up doing an awful lot for free, you know, particularly when you're trying to get ready for Edinburgh or something like Edinburgh, you know, you end up, it's a struggle to get the gigs that you need to do.
It reminds me of, I did a bunch of podcasts in Australia when I was there in 2013.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of the people, a lot of the comics I spoke to there had it seemed similar in terms of like, I'm a comic, I'm working. The only time I can make money is if I go to a festival and have a successful show every day for a month.
Yeah.
Because that's a way to actually support myself. Because in terms of a circuit, it's much harder to to put it all together, to fill in the gap, so you've got a full diary and you go, yes, this is me. So I spoke to a lot of comics out there who were very successful, high-functioning comics who nonetheless also had secondary jobs and...
Yeah.
You know, other bits and bobs.
Yeah, and I suppose their car journeys must be massive.
Yeah, much longer. Yeah. Fewer chats, but much, much longer ones.
Yeah.
So tell me then about how you started comedy, how you got into it.
Yeah, I was actually interested in getting into acting, and I started auditioning for acting schools in the UK and in Ireland. And part of that process was to do comedy improv.
Part of the audition process?
Yeah, the audition.
Oh,
yeah,
whereabouts did they do that?
Loads of places. Acton, I did the Poor School, an audition for school in King's Cross. Oxford, there's a quite a nice school out there.
Oh, yes. Yes, it might be called like the Oxford Drama School or something, but it's not in Oxford, is it?
It's like it's a, in a quite farm
a long bus
or something,
ride away
like,
from Oxford, I remember. I auditioned for that myself.
I kept being asked to do comedy improv for the auditions, and I didn't know, or not comedy, it was improv, but I didn't know, I'd never done that before. So I just signed up with a group in Dublin to maybe help me get better at that.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the people who were doing comedy improv at the time were also doing stand-up. So it was more of a social connection. I ended up kind of going to their gigs to support them.
Okay.
And then eventually going, give me a go.
Okay, go on. Yeah. Let's focus on that. Why give me a go? Because you wanted to be up there, or you thought you could do it better? Or
I thought I could do it better.
No, I love it. Brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. And and so what was the... were you scared when you first did it? Did you think... I mean, so people come to comedy in lots and lots of different ways. And I suppose if you're coming to it from the point of view of being a performer already, being an actress...
Yeah.
Were you an actress, or were you kind of a wannabe actress?
Wannabe. I'd done bits in amateur plays, but I hadn't done any professional work at that stage. I actually did a course. I did a stand-up comedy course. And loads of comedians I know rubbish courses and say, you know, you can't learn... Comedy can't be taught. But actually, it was how I kind of got over my nerves to do comedy, because you're with other people, you're preparing some material.
Yes.
You get to try it out in some way before you do it on stage.
That must be really valuable, actually.
That aspect, I wouldn't say you can teach comedy. You can't teach somebody to be funny, but you can kind of, it's like a prepared kind of closeted environment where somebody who is really nervous...
And who might be funny anyway.
Yes,
but they're not going to find out unless they're sufficiently kind of couched and well, not couched really, but protected and told this is reasonable. We can all do this. Yeah,
yeah. Because the self-doubt, obviously is huge at that stage. So, that was, it served that function for me.
Okay.
But it might be useful for other people.
And did you tell me about the course you did? How long did it last for? How many sort of sessions were there? What sort of function did it take? I've never done one. I've taught a few, but
really?
I've never done. Well, only for I say only, but I have a friend who directs a theatre school in London, and he occasionally gets me in to do like one day a year with their students. And there's all these students who are just desperate, like, I don't want to do it. I hate it. I don't know. But he's forcing them to by putting a gig on for them. He says, right, in 2 weeks you're doing a comedy night, so do you want to come to this workshop with a comedian? They'll go, oh God, yes, okay then. And so I've kind of done some loose exercises, many of them cribbed from Oliver Double's brilliant book about how to do stuff like that, and then kind of improvised as I go. But having never been on the receiving end of that, what was that like for you? What sorts of things were you doing?
It was very informal. As you say, I don't know that there's a kind of a right way or a wrong way to do it now. It just we just came in with our ideas, and told them to one another and, verbalised them and made suggestions, about what we might do. There was four in the group and one guy kind of leading it. We did it for 3 hours every Saturday for 6 weeks. And then the last, it was a gig we were working towards.
Okay.
And the gig was the first round of a comedy competition.
Okay, yeah. Oh, that's nice.
So it was like Flashdance or something like that. This kind of thing we're working towards.
Did any of your other three go on to become comics?
One of them is coming to Edinburgh to stay with me today, actually.
Amazing.
Yeah, he's not doing a show this year, but he's still at it, Garrod Farrelly.
Oh, yeah, I know him. I was chatting to him recently. He interviewed me for a radio show.
Yeah, he's got a podcast.
Yes. Oh, yeah, for a podcast he was doing. Lovely guy, yeah.
Yeah, he's great, and great comic. I think it's just the two of us. Yeah, there was a Finnish girl and another girl from Limerick that hasn't continued.
Okay.
But, it was... It was excellent, actually. Yeah, you know, once nobody tried to tell me what was funny, you know, because I don't think, you know, I think people are right about that.
Yes, I think people who haven't done courses probably have a preconception about courses that it's someone telling you what you've got to be like.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, I think maybe some courses are like that.
Yeah.
So your first gig, do you regard that as your first gig, the one from the course?
I do, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
The first round of that competition, it was in a pub. I invited everybody I knew.
Brave. You must have been feeling confident.
Oh, I was totally deluded about my abilities. They all came, and I think I came third in the competition of eight that night. I ended up getting to the final of it, but it was purely out of, likability in terms of, God, this girl is, you know, so vulnerable and nervous, you know, that maybe that appealed to people.
And was that all real, that vulnerability?
Yeah,
and nervousness?
Absolutely.
That was all, you were just channeling what was going on, you were just being yourself.
Yes, yeah, and it became actually followed me for years, like, and I still kind of struggle, not, I wouldn't say struggle now, but debate that all the time in my mind, is am I nervous or am I just affecting nervousness on stage.
Yes, because it's funny, actually, when I saw your show, which I thought was brilliant, by the way,
Thank you.
Help the Frigid, tremendous title.
Thank you.
When I saw your show, I was struck by how mature the material was and how you were pulling loads and loads of things out of a subject, loads of kind of curveball punchlines, compared to how it looked a little bit like you were sort of winging it.
Your
persona is very much like, it's sort of, here it is, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. You know. Yeah, well, that I've all, like, my first, I suppose, few years doing stand-up, I had this, I suppose it's a nervous tick, you know, of kind of holding back, you know, like taking an extra second maybe about delivering or stumbling over a word or something like that. And I suppose I had conversations with people, and I began to realise that it wasn't so much an artistic choice. I was pretending to myself it was an artistic choice, but really it was because I was really nervous about what I was doing. And then I kind of said, well, no, I'm going to try not to do that. I'm going to try and be certain about what I'm saying. So what I'm trying to do now is be certain, but the nerves are still there and I'm still you know,
and presumably
dealing with
if
them
that
all
was,
the time.
That was part of the crucible that formed you as a comic. Is there a sense by which you kind of go, well, my funniest self is a nervous girl?
No, I don't think it is. I think I'm trying to do stand up in spite of it all.
Okay.
You know, I'm trying to get over it all and be the certain person, you know, on stage. It's getting in the way, but I think it's a braver choice to try and not turn it into something else, to try and just do it with it, you know, and hopefully a solid thing will emerge from it.
Yes, but then there's, but the thing is, it's, I suppose what I'm talking about is not really sort of nervousness or kind of diffidence on your part. It's more, it's kind of the way you're talking to me now. Your face is just so kind of alive and kind of light and curious. Like, you've really got, and don't take this the wrong way, you've got a really good natural clown.
Wow, okay.
I really think you do, because you're just kind of like, here I am, and you're sort of curious and excited and stuff like that. And I think that kind of bubbles underneath the stuff that you do.
Great.
I'd need to be careful about saying, oh, you look nervous on stage. That's sort of not what I mean. I meant you had this kind of frothy thing whereby you're doing proper, incisive, mature stand-up whilst at the same time seeming like you're kind of, I don't know, there's a sort of an innocence or a naivety to you that's really appealing.
Oh, great.
On stage, you know what I mean? It's like, oh, it's like this. And then when you say something cutting, which you frequently do, there's a lovely joke. I mean, a woman next to me snorted. I can't remember what the line was, but you're talking about, I think maybe a spiritual advisor. Like, you've never met a spiritual advisor that didn't turn out to be a cunt. Was that, know the line.
Yeah, I have that. Yeah, it's, I know a girl that has a master's in spirituality, but she's still a cunt.
My God, that was such a killer line. Because it's such a curveball to the you that we're
I know, yeah. It's difficult to kind of pull it all together. And I know what you're talking about. There is a kind of that solid thing is just this kind of really certain dismissive person. Who is probably writing a lot of the stuff, but the person who's presenting it seems a little bit more unsure.
So that's interesting. So that came from you had a lot of problems with nerves in those early gigs. On the note of material, do you remember any of your material from that first gig?
Do you remember your opener?
I've just recently on the podcast got into asking people what their first ever opening line was. I'd love to know.
I had a 7-minute bit about it was about how, and I did it in So You Think You're Funny, actually. It was about how I was a normal person. And I suppose it was semi a character, but how I had went on and represented Ireland in the normal Olympics, and the Special Olympics had been just on in Ireland the previous year.
Yeah.
So I basically gave out about the Special Olympics for taking attention away from the normal Olympics.
That's lovely.
Yeah. So I talked about what that was. Yeah.
Okay. And how long did you hold on to that bit of material as you were?
About a year, and then I realised I had to. It didn't work in sets that were any longer than 7 minutes.
Okay.
And when I started to add on other jokes, it didn't work because it was too much of a character.
Yes, I understand.
So I was moving into something different. So eventually, I started getting asked to do 20 minutes, and I was dying. Because it just didn't make sense. Or it was like two separate gigs, one starting and being 7 minutes, and then the second 13 minutes being a totally different comedian.
So the journey of you doing, I hate the word journey, sorry, but the path of you kind of, it's not better, especially if I've heard the word path isn't any better if you're just using it instead. But the competition that you did at the end of your course, was that So You Think You're Funny? Did that feed into that?
No, there was a comedy festival in Dublin at the time that was running this competition for new stand-ups.
Gotcha.
Similar thing though, very, you know, kind of the same, yeah.
Okay. And what was your experience of the competitions? Did you find them helpful, unpleasant? What was your kind of, I know when a lot of people start, they kind of go, right, the competitions, I've got to win Laughing Horse, I've got to get to the finals of BBC, you know.
I would have been ambitious in that way, in the same way as other people, yeah. And then just was unsuccessful and just said, then competitions don't matter.
Yeah.
I'll play the long game, you know, which I suppose you do anyway, you know, you kind of have to.
There is only a long game, isn't there?
Yeah.
So you are in a situation where you're starting to get booked for 20s.
Yes.
And you're using that stuff that you were using before and having to get rid of it. So are you having a kind of crisis at this point going, oh, Jesus, 7 of this doesn't work anymore?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I had to write a whole new 20. And, you know, I suppose it was weaker than the first 7, you know, and struggled with that for ages. But, you know, people were patient with me. And I've had loads of crisis, you know, over the 10 years I've been doing it, you know, where material hasn't been working and, you know, I've kind of haven't known why, and it'll take me ages to figure it out.
Is that frustrating that process takes longer because you can't gig 5 times a week?
Yeah. Well, I'm probably more willing than most, maybe. I'll do a free gig. I just have to do it to get up there and be gigging, you know, because I don't think I can afford to let money stand in the way of just the development of what you're doing. I will go and gig whatever it takes.
So let's talk about that development then. How would you say what are the key differences in what you're doing now to what you were doing in your first few years of your career?
There's more of a flow to what I'm doing now in terms of the set. You can take less of it out and as a joke, you know, and isolate it as a joke.
Because it's longer bits and
it's more long form
stuff like that. Okay.
I would have had times. I definitely had a time about 2 years ago where I wasn't stuff wasn't working. I was writing good jokes, but it wasn't working. And eventually I just said, well, if I'm going to die on my arse, I'm going to die saying what I want to say. You know, that was great, actually. That was really, because I feel now that I do, the things I'm saying, I kind of stand over.
Yeah.
And that's a nice feeling to have.
So are you,
stuff.
Can you give us an example of for people that haven't seen you and
sure.
listen to this all over the place? Can you give us an example of like your favourite bit? What's your favourite bit from your new show? What do you get the most pleasure from doing or saying in your latest show?
Yeah, I have a bit at the moment, and I'm doing a bit about Mrs. Brown's Boys.
Oh, yeah.
In my
yeah.
show. I've been working on this since the bit is about Nelson Mandela when he passed away the end of last year. And the fans of Mrs. Brown's Boys actually ended up, 850 of them wrote to the BBC to complain that their programme had been interrupted. I made up a letter based on what the tweets were about the time and that. I suppose it kind of feels it feels good to do it. But I also, now in the show, what I do is I actually make an argument about why they were right to write the letters. One of the things I'm kind of frustrated with in England and Ireland and Scotland is the way the liberal media will often just take a tone of dismissiveness towards people who aren't maybe don't have the same value system mm-hmm. as they do. I like even though I hate Mrs. Brown's Boys as a thing. I like standing up for the fans of Mrs. Brown's Boys, you know, against the big media.
Yes, okay.
People. So that's something I get a kick out of.
And that's
it's morally complex enough for me.
Yes.
I love things that are kind of
that's
not
great.
Easy.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
They have to be teased out.
Definitely. There was some stuff you did about Chris Brown.
Yes,
as well. Can you tell
true.
Us about that, but sort of explore what that premise is and where that came from?
Yeah, I do this joke about how Chris Brown came to Dublin and he got a lot of criticism from people because he didn't seem to understand that Ireland was not part of the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And people were, I thought it was really stupid that people got annoyed with Chris Brown for that reason.
Yes.
You know, if you want to get, you know, there are other reasons why you might get, you know, get angry with Chris Brown. And,
sure.
you know, nationalism is such a frustrating kind of concept, you know,
yeah.
the way some people just take it, you know, and use it to bash people with. But it seemed like there was this kind of I was trying to figure out reasons that you might boo Chris Brown, you know, and you know, where him knowing where Dublin is, that I didn't think that was a good reason. You might shout at him because of his past with Rihanna,
mm-hmm.
either or his music. Like that would be that's also another reason why you might take issue
yeah.
with him. So yeah, I love messing around with kind of really kind of murky stuff,
yes.
murky
yeah.
moral stuff like that.
And
yeah.
I mean, it's great. I really enjoyed both of those bits, and I think it's interesting that you kind of your eyes sort of lit up there when you're talking about. Oh, I love the moral ambiguity kind of stuff, moral complexity.
And it's always those big things that are the. I don't know, that's really what's so attractive, but they don't always work as well. It's because they're difficult.
So how do you cope when they don't work? How do you cope as a performer and as a person when something like that isn't working on stage?
It just gets easier. I just try not to be, just to hold that, you know, you tried it and it didn't work, you know.
Can you think that to yourself on stage when it's not working? Can part of you go, nope, this is fine, keep going?
You just try not to do it, because there's easy things you can do. You can go, oh, that didn't work, you know, and the crowd will laugh.
That's
you know?
A new bit, I'm
yeah.
not doing that again.
I know,
yeah,
but... I suppose that's even disappointing for the audience too, though, to kind of take that out. You know, you tried it and it didn't work, and you know that's. I don't have an answer really. I don't know what to do about that really.
Do you care whether or not they like you?
I do, but I do care. But there is, I mean, I would find certain comedians that, you know, work very hard and do it in an easy way, in a needy way. If I get a sense of neediness off the performer, then I immediately switch off them. So I would try not to appear needy. I know I like comedians that don't, that, you know, I suppose don't say what I want to hear or don't confirm all my beliefs to me.
Eleanor Tiernan, then. Great conversation here with a really great act. Do look her up on YouTube. She's got a superb routine called We Need to Talk About Ireland, as well as loads of other great club stuff. Apologies for my bunged up voice and nose at the moment. Sorry about that. Can't be much fun to listen to. I'll keep this brief. We've had an email from a listener, David Horner, in, I'm going to go with Hoboken. It might be Hoboken, possibly. That's a bit Hadurken, don't know. Hoboken sounds like somewhere amazing in America. Or possibly Canada. I think it's America. David says, thanks for all the great insight into comedy and the human mind. One thing that strikes me about comedy and the challenges to income is that it's so very difficult to buy comedy. There's little scope outside of the mainstream comics on iTunes or Audible, and without sites, he says, like Go Faster Stripe, it would be impossible to get hold of material from the likes of, e.g., Dan Antopolsky. Even Go Faster Stripe has its issues with reaching a global market with only having a few downloads and most of it on DVD. In a nutshell, he says, comedians need to make it easier for punters around the world to drop $10 on them. Thank you, David. Thanks for your donation as well. I think that's a good point. I certainly feel that I and other comics of my ilk are kind of stuck in a cycle of doing Edinburgh and then hoping to tour that show and then clinging on to that show if we don't tour it in the hope that one day we can do it or bits of it on TV. Is it better to just get the stuff out there? And if it is it better to put it out there for free, or is it better to try and charge money for it? What are the, what, I suppose what you want ultimately is as many people to hear it as possible. But obviously you've put all of this work into something that often at the festival has cost you money to perform. You do sort of find yourself thinking, wouldn't it be great if I could put a show on Bandcamp and charge £3 for it? Would anyone pay for it? Would that happen? Is it better to give it away and turn those people into fans? Let me know your thoughts from the perspective of an act, or indeed of a punter, a comedy consumer, and we'll talk about it in future shows. You too can donate by clicking on the PayPal button at comedianscomedian.com, and you can decide how much to send to support the show. £5, £10, £20, or the gold standard of donations, which is, of course, £1 a show. It's not a fee. You're under no obligation. And I want you to listen to these shows first and foremost, as we were just saying. But if you can afford to donate, you pay for the people who can't. And they'll never know that you donated on their behalves. But you'll know in your heart you're the comedy equivalent of Batman. So, more live news now before we go back in. Alexis Dubas is putting on a Hidden Gems of Edinburgh Fringe Festival in Brixton from October the 20th to the 23rd. Now, I don't have ticket links or information for that. I would imagine if you go to his Facebook page, Alexis Dubas, D-U-B-U-S, you will be able to find all sorts of information there. Or Google, I mean, he's capitalised Hidden Gems of Edinburgh Fringe, so it might be that that is Googleable with the word Brixton. I'm not sure, but so far he's got Matt Ewins, who you know that I love, Will Hodgson, brilliant Will Hodgson, doing his show on British Hangmen, which I didn't get to see in Edinburgh. A show Alexis told me about called What the Fuck Is This, which sounds incredible. Now, I want to say that's Richard Tyrone Jones, but I'm not completely 100% sure it's him, so forgive me if I'm miscrediting that, but it sounds bananas. Monkey Poet and Rob Orton's Face Show, which is performance poetry slash comedy, I guess. I've not seen Rob Orton or indeed Monkey Poet, I will try and get myself along there to that. The Hidden Gems of Edinburgh Fringe Festival in Brixton between the 20th and 23rd of October. Thank you, finally, to Danny Davies for putting on the Tom Stade live ComCom show earlier this week, and to everyone that came along. It was an absolute blinder from the minute Tom first opened his mouth. It was just superb, and that's going to come out next week. Now, though, let's get back to Eleanor Tiernan.
Who were your sort of inspirations in the world of comedy? Were you into stand-ups before you went on the course and were interacting?
Not at all.
Or was there something you discovered through being
with other
comics?
Stuart Lee, I think, is a great example of that. You know, somebody who... I'm sure Stuart must care whether he's liked or not, you know, but, you know, he doesn't... He has, I suppose, created this persona that is... he would be popular in school, I think, Stuart Lee.
That's interesting.
Wouldn't he?
Do you think? I mean, certainly he was very arch when he first started, and you can see videos of him online looking incredibly young. As everyone, it was a long time ago, but looking kind of young and sort of achingly hip.
I know.
And you sort of go, you must have, like, maybe if he wasn't popular in school, maybe he owned that and was like, well, I don't need you.
You get that
sort of thing. Certainly had the confidence, I think.
Owning it is a good way of kind of capturing it, I think. No, he's given himself the freedom, I think. But I suppose some comedians' personas vary from like the cheerful children's television presenter type to somebody who is like, you know, Andrew Lawrence, you know, is you know quite dark, you know, and, you know, doesn't say kind of crowd pleasing things. And you can like all of them, you know. You can like all of these people. And they all care about being liked, I think.
You know? So you're... It's funny, actually. You were on... You did Head Wreckers?
Yes.
Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a little Google of you. Now, I've not seen Head Wreckers. All I know about it was Dave McSavage in that.
Yeah.
Because I know Dave from the olden days, from
of
the
course,
straight days.
Yeah.
And he came up recently in a podcast I did with Phil Kay, because the two of them, there was a period where they were kind of hanging out, and I don't think they were sleeping rough. They certainly looked like it. But he's someone that I really think of in that kind of provocative, not caring if anyone likes
actually,
him.
Actually, he's an excellent example of somebody that doesn't say things to kind of please the crowd.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because you do think, what are you... I always used to... he was so electrifying to watch, and I saw him far more as a street performer than I ever did as a stand-up. He was so provocative and so original and so rude. I remember one of his gags used to be at Hunter Square here at the festival. A bus would go past and he'd get his whole crowd to wave at the people on the bus, and he'd see when the lights were changing, and as the bus drove away, he'd go, now give him the finger, give him the finger. And get like 200 people to give the finger to the bus. And I always thought that was a really interesting interplay between pissing people off and making people happy.
I know, yeah. But I think, like, I because we're comedians, I'm kind of talking about it in terms of maybe quite a meta level, but people like it when you're mean to them as well. You know, I don't think you're necessarily putting audiences off by being an asshole.
Yeah, right.
You know, they just want you, as you say, your word to own it. If you own what you're doing, I think people will go a long way.
And you have to own it, and it has to be, they have to buy it as well, because...
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I think we've all probably seen newer comics experiment with being provocative, and the audience is going, we don't believe you.
Yeah,
we don't.
I know.
I don't believe you're this misanthropic. I don't believe you're this arch.
Yeah. I saw a young comic in Dublin recently doing some stuff, and, you know, going on about how crap his life is, you know, and, you know, he was trying to play a kind of a loser character, but he was somebody who clearly, you know, he's only a young guy, you know, he's clearly articulate.
Yeah, totally.
You know, and he's talking about how he can't hold down a job. You know, you can. You're just too lazy.
That would be much funnier for him to come and go, I can hold down a job, but I'm just too lazy.
But I suppose people are trying out different things, you know, before with the crowd before they really get to something that's authentic.
Mm. So tell me what you get out of it when you do a good gig. What elements of it satisfy you the most?
I suppose I get a bit of a kick out of being articulate, you know, in front of people.
That's an interesting way to say it. Go on, what does that mean?
I suppose using words to and conveying what I mean, the thoughts I've had, you know, the inner stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, why would you get a kick out of that in front of an audience?
I suppose there's a bit of ego involved in it.
Yeah, okay.
You know, in the way of, you know, being on the radio or something like that, you know,
sure.
And, you know, sounding like you know what you're talking about.
Now, do you feel you know what you're talking about? Or do you feel you're getting away with it?
No, it's a total cheat because I thought about it before I got up there, you know.
Yeah, okay.
You know, so the crowd think that you haven't, but yeah, it's... that's I definitely get that out of it. I suppose the best gigs, you know, my better gigs will I will have had a laugh myself doing them. That's quite rewarding.
That is something we don't think about nearly enough as comics, I think, is the actual enjoyment of doing a gig.
Yeah.
Like the actual in the moment for its own sake. Oh, this is great. It's like being on a roller coaster. Brilliant.
Yeah, and I've treated them like kind of academic exercises, you know, something that can be gotten right.
Yeah.
Gigs can be, you know, as what is the right way to do this
I'm
gig?
I'm definitely guilty of that. That's a really interesting observation, yeah.
You're stealing something from yourself and from the audience by doing having that expectation.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's funny, like, looking back at your stuff. I did some gigs with Reg D. Hunter before, and he was kind enough to sit and look at some of my stuff with me afterwards. And it was really clear, you know, and he was able to kind of point out what bits were alive and what bits were just me doing, you know, saying what I, you know, pre-prepared,
okay.
Clever
ideas you'd have.
Yeah, that I was trying to impress maybe or something like that. I thought this is the right way to do comedy, you know.
So tell me more about that. That's fascinating. Which bits? Can you give us an example of a bit of each?
It was in my face, you know, where I was excited, you know, and you know there was a definite sense of you know excitement in the room that was on the video.
Yes.
I could see it, you know, and in my performance.
That would be a fascinating exercise to try and be honest with yourself, look through your set and go, which bits of these do I just cannot wait to do because they're alive?
Yeah.
Alive and dead, that's a really interesting kind of way to slice the setup.
Yeah, and be open to possibility. I'm very scripted, actually, and what I have found lately is I've been going down to do Up the Creek a little bit in London and in Greenwich, and... I'll tell you a story. I really regret what I did that one of the open spot nights I did. There was this. They're doing this competition on a Thursday night, I think, where they encourage people to. It's a competition, but it's a gong show. That's
okay,
the name, isn't it?
Yeah.
And new acts are coming on. And they're all doing 5 minutes, but I had to go up and do 10 minutes. And the host, this was in the middle of it, so in the middle of a set of really new comedians.
Yes.
Here's this supposedly experienced comedian coming on and doing 10 minutes.
And that's how you introduced.
This is what I was.
And now a proper one.
And now a proper one. But then the host said to the crowd, he said, "If you wouldn't mind, don't heckle her," and they had been encouraging heckling all night of the new acts because it's a gong show.
Okay.
"If you wouldn't mind, don't heckle her because she has come over to do it and she's trying out for the club, you know." But, and I went up and I did my set and I was so annoyed and went fine and I got the gig, but it was such a missed opportunity, I thought, because what I should have done, the honourable thing to have done would have been to go up and say, "No, you have to treat me the same as all of the other acts. In fact, you have to be worse to me because I'm doing this longer than all these other people."
Sure.
I was such a coward that I really, really annoyed myself that I just wanted the gig. You know, I had come all the way from Ireland, you know, and I was like, I've paid the plane fare and all this, you know, and I wanted to go well. But
and it's almost like by saying that, by putting that remark in front of your show, they've really reduced how alive it is.
Absolutely, yes. That's the alive dead thing. You know, if I had had the balls to say that to the crowd, I don't know. I kind of think the club would have kind of gone for it anyway.
Sure,
if I had done that,
yeah,
I'm sure they would have. But it would have been a much more exciting proposition and a much more what stand up is about. I would have respected myself as a comedian a lot more if I had done that. So
that's difficult. I remember I've definitely had situations like that where it's almost like the thing has ossified. It's kind of frozen because of the what you feel is going on outside of the actual performance.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like I've really got, I'm sure I've hamstrung myself on numerous occasions by going, okay, this really has to be good, so I'll play it safe. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Almost that ridiculous kind of thing, rather than going, right, every time it's got to be, it's got to be alive.
I know, yeah,
and I'll live or die on that basis.
Yeah,
rather than, but then you have to, I guess the industry is sort of designed almost for good or ill, it's sort of such that, you know, when you do a 10 at the Comedy Store, you've got to do all your best stuff and smash it.
Yeah.
And I think there are people, comics are few and far between, I think, who would go, right, this is my 10 at the Comedy Store, I've got to improvise and make it different and fresh and alive.
I know, yeah.
That's a really interesting, and I think particularly in your work, if you look at your bit about, you've got this sort of like feminist related material about the subject of that, about the danger of you being kicked out of women.
I know,
like,
yeah.
I think
yeah.
that's a brilliant, brilliant bit. It's a really clever idea, but it also lives on the stage.
Yeah.
And so how do you synthesize those two things of going, I've got the clever stuff that I want to say. And I don't mean clever in a negative way. I just mean it's intelligent and, you know, evocative and interesting.
Yeah.
There's one kind of, maybe, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I certainly feel there's one magnetic pull saying, improvise, follow the laughs. If something's getting a laugh, do it again.
Yeah,
you know, those kind of visceral things.
Yeah.
And then there's the intellectual stuff of, I want to get my point across.
I know, yeah. I went on tour with Tommy Tiernan. Very new, when I was very new, I was only 3 years doing it, and we did a big tour around Ireland, and I was doing 20s before his show, and I was kind of just on the cusp of, I just abandoned that first 7 minutes of material that I had, actually.
Okay,
I think,
so you're properly in the zone of going,
Yeah, and but I was still too nervous to kind of really try new stuff, you know, with the kind of, I suppose, enthusiasm that you need to, you know, to write often enough. So I ended up trapped in this 120 minutes that I was doing for a whole, I think, a year almost, okay, around Ireland. And I was thoroughly sick of myself and hated my material, and but didn't
Why did you hate it? Just because you'd done it too many times, or because you didn't feel it was your best stuff, but you couldn't take risks in those environments? Is that what you mean?
I felt I couldn't take risks. I thought it. I was fed up of doing it, but also, I suppose, as a comedian, you always feel like there's something that else that you should be saying, and I suppose that's never truer than when you're new, a new comedian, because you're saying what's funny rather than what you maybe believe, or you're getting to having a point of view on the world, that kind of thing. So those combination of factors, and then I suppose you have your aspirations are quite, you know, big and bold at that stage as well. So that combination of things, I just felt totally trapped behind this 20 minutes of it, and felt like the comedy was getting in the way, actually, of crack.
Yes,
at the gig.
Yes.
God,
that's funny.
I'm looser now, I think. Than
yes.
I'm really glad I'm willing to try new stuff on a big stage, you know.
Yes, that's quite a hard one, isn't it? If you've come to it, especially if you come to it as an actress, maybe.
Yeah.
Or that there's some sense that there's a script or a way that it needs to be done. Actually giving yourself permission for it to be loose.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have that feeling about myself at all, of being a kind of a natural comedian in the way that, you know, a lot of people do.
Sure.
The playfulness is, and I love it when I do it, but it doesn't come kind of naturally to me.
I'd really like to talk to you about a specific bit that you did, which I've seen on YouTube, which is the It's Not Your Fault.
Oh,
bit,
yeah.
Which
yeah.
I thought was just lovely. Just tell us a bit about what that
thanks.
Piece is and the circumstances under which you were doing it. I didn't entirely understand the context of the show.
I was at, there's this thing in Dublin where they organise nights, which are basically speeches, and people come together and give a 6 or 7 minute talk on what they, anything they want, I suppose. And I was invited. There's a bit of a theme to them, and they're they're very kind of Irish centric, you know, and, you know, where are we? Ireland is constantly asking ourselves, we're always asking ourselves, where are we? What? We're at a crossroads now, Ireland. What are we going to do about the future? I went along to one of these nights I had a really kind of, it's funny because they're very well-meaning, you know, and sometimes with comedy that can just, if I have to do comedy and try and be well-meaning as well, that can just turn me off completely. I just can't see the funny in it. I had just come from Australia, actually, I'd just on a holiday over there, and I find travel and particularly that journey quite hard, and it takes me a long time to get out of the jet lag that I have when I go away. So I found myself in the Gallery of Modern Art in Brisbane.
Yes,
which is a wonderful.
I've been. It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing. And there was a big exhibition at the time, which was Aboriginal anger about how they were treated and articulating all through beautiful visual art. Mm. And I thought, what a healthy thing! And it actually, kind of pulled me out of the funk I was in at the time in Australia. I had artistic purpose again.
Ah, great.
Suddenly,
okay.
Yeah, you know. But I came back to Dublin, and the next thing I had to do was this talk, and. I suppose the whole thing kind of combined, and I was asked to do, you know, what do you want to say, Eleanor? So I decided to take the idea of therapy and putting Ireland into therapy. I do therapy myself. So one of the things that my therapist asked me to do is to imagine that there's a 7-year-old Eleanor in the room.
Yeah.
And what would I say to her now? And all of the, you know, would I blame her for, you know, maybe things that happened? And what I say then is I tell her things aren't her fault. So I imagined that that was on a national level in the talk, and I got the crowd to imagine that there was a 7-year-old Ireland in the room. I listed out all of the things that some serious, some not so serious, but things that have happened to Ireland in the past.
Yeah.
And I got the crowd to say, "It's not your fault." It seemed to kind of catch
it's
fire.
It's such a beautiful premise. It's lovely.
Thank you. Yeah,
it was a great opportunity for loads of jokes, as you say, loads of just sort of it's almost like a list of observations that doesn't feel like a list because the premise is so strong.
Yeah. And it's a funny thing because choosing that list put a lot of thought into what things to choose, because there are very serious things that kind of happen to Ireland, and you don't want people to think to drag it into that territory, because it's, you know, sexual abuse in the Catholic Church and all those things, you know, and they're not obviously funny things. But I suppose as a group, I think people suffer traumas as groups together, that there may be an opportunity to try and heal in that way. I'm doing a show next month, actually, on it. In the Dublin Fringe Festival.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm writing that while
I'm
here,
actually. Oh, great. Do you know when and where? And I'll chuck this one out earlier than I might have so that we can get...
It's in Liberty Hall is the name of the venue. And it's actually in the same place that the Proclamation of Ireland's Independence was printed, which is a really historical document.
Okay.
I'm calling it the National Therapy Project.
Wow, great.
Yeah, so I bring people in.
Okay.
Put them on mats on the floor, like a meditation session, and we begin to meditate through our collective trauma.
That's such a lovely idea.
Yeah, we're going to do it now next month. So I'm writing the script, the meditation script, while I'm here.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah, so it's fun.
Are you happy to talk about your therapy?
As a
comic for whom it's a matter of record now to the podcast and many of my shows. I mean, I go to therapy. I go to Gestalt psychotherapy.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
I don't really, people say, what does that mean? I honestly don't know. We do similar sort of exercises to what you're talking about.
Yeah.
But I found it incredibly useful. And I wondered, it's interesting. I found it very hard to talk about on stage. Only really this festival have I kind of found, you know, you do loads of other peripheral gigs up here at Edinburgh and you don't want to use material that's in your show because you want to say, hey, people at the gig, come to my show. So I've ended up doing some stuff that I dropped from this show about going to therapy. I've got this story about going to a suspiciously cheap therapist. and it's nice because I've come out of it going, oh, actually, now that I'm not trying to force this into...
my current Edinburgh show, actually it's breathing a bit more and there might be something in it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, have you talked on stage about doing therapy?
I've written jokes about it.
Talk to us about the experience of that and how that goes down and the challenges of doing that material.
Yeah, I don't think I've really gotten to the heart of articulating, because like there's an observation I have about it that like some of the cringy things that I end up saying in therapy, and they're cringy, but they're also necessary, you know. But like I end up saying things like, I met John today. Yeah, we had a conversation and I managed to shut the fuck up for 5 minutes during it. That's real progress. No, he didn't ask me out, but I did create a space for it to happen. You know, this kind of, you know, and I haven't been able to kind of, I suppose, eke out a story from it, you know, mm-hmm. or a point of view that's audience worthy yet. But I definitely feel that it has helped me to kind of get more in the moment of what I'm doing, I suppose talk to her about what some of my fears. It's good to have somebody to talk through the process with as well. Like I talk to her about comedy. I do.
And what sorts of things? What kind of conversations do you have?
I suppose it's something that happened, you know, at a gig, you know, stuff that it just might take you a while to kind of get the words out of what annoyed you about it or what you were afraid of in the situation, what you were worried other people were thinking about you. You know, that's what ends up coming out of my mouth in there.
So does comedy make you more or less happy?
More happy, I think.
Are you happy in life?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. I'm really, if I didn't have like this kind of really strong purpose to pursue, and like I was really unhappy before I did comedy, like, you know, trying to work away in a 9-to-5 job, you know, that was really, it didn't kind of connect, or it didn't, it wasn't fulfilling in the way that I needed something to fulfil me. Not having that was really, I'm terrified of that now, you know. And when I mentioned there about being in Australia, you know, have an artistic purpose has the power to kind of really lift me out of, you know, a kind of a dark mood if that comes upon me, you know. I feel very lucky to kind of have something that I feel that strongly about.
That's brilliant. I'm really pleased for you. I think I certainly, it's up to my girlfriend sometimes to remind me how well I'm doing these days now that I feel, you know what I mean? Because part of the problems I have is that I always imagine that however I feel in the moment is how I always feel.
I know.
So if I'm happy, I'm manic. And if I'm depressed, I'm like, God, this is awful. It was always like this.
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder for myself, and I wonder if it's true for you, whether comedy also... does it create other psychological challenges as well as solving a bunch of them?
Or
is it all positive?
I suppose I probably, I do have the sense that I have, you know, kind of missed out a little bit on social life and, you know, kind of missing out on, you know, occasions somebody got married while I'm here that I wasn't at the wedding for, you know. Yeah. So I do have an anxiety a little bit that, you know, I probably, you know, regret, you know, certain things, but you know, I wouldn't swap it. This is a weird thing now, but I do find sometimes, I don't even know if it's connected, but I thought of it there a second ago. I do find sometimes being a woman in comedy that the whole hormonal thing can get in the way a little bit.
Okay.
Of funny that. And I often don't get, it doesn't feel like it's ever, worth mentioning ever or whatever. But it does, like, I suppose you would often find that you're just not in the fucking humour.
Yeah, okay.
But obviously the demands of the job are such that you don't have you can't choose when you have to be funny. So that would
be some pretty shifty diary work to plan all of that in advance.
Yeah, I've had some days, you know, where I've had to, you know, a really big gig will come along. And it's just the wrong day for me.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I've not heard anyone say that before, but of course that would, you know, that might be an issue.
Yeah, it does. But actually it was your thing of just not knowing when that happens, you can never say, oh, it'll be okay tomorrow. It's always awful right now, and it's never going to be better than it is, like, you know.
Yeah. Just staying on some of the... I don't want to say negative elements of it, but the difficulties that I think a lot of artists, a lot of creative people have with believing in their own creativity and those sorts of things. And it sounds like largely you don't experience those. You know, if comedy is, if you're getting such a buzz out of it because you're like, this is fixing my life.
Yeah.
I mean, do you question, do you second guess yourself? Do you write stuff and go, this is clearly shit, and then it turns out to work?
Absolutely. And I feel I struggle sometimes with it'll be the other way, that I feel sometimes like I'm trying to work out some personal thing, and, you know, that I'm you know, using the audience for that, you know, that I'm doing stuff, you know, trying to work stuff out on stage that is only for me, and, you know, I shouldn't be burdening the audience with it. That's where I would have experienced self-doubt.
Yes, because you're trying to tread a path that says I have to say what I want to say.
Yeah.
I have to please myself, not them. There's presumably then a line where you go, you know, to what extent?
Exactly, yeah. Because I suppose the funny is obviously the you know, the goal and the barometer of everything that we're doing. So you can have something that's just confessional, but is you know, maybe not funny yet, and maybe never will be, you know. So, but yeah, of course, really self doubt. I have a lot of self doubt around that that stuff.
Mm. Do you read your own reviews ever?
I'm getting braver about it. I would have been very fragile before, but yeah, no, I'm getting a bit braver about doing it.
And what kind of reviews? Like, I've had this thought to ask people in the past. You'll be my guinea pig for this one, because I've not asked this question before.
Sure.
Might be fecund, might be interesting. If you were to review yourself, what things would you pick up on?
Yeah.
What things would you, standing outside yourself, not 7 years old, you now, looking in at you now,
yeah,
what would you say, that needs work?
You need to prepare more before you go on stage, Anna. You need to give up this idea that you should be, you know, coming up with it all on the spot. You know, that I have that fear about it, and actually
The fear from which direction? You feel you should be doing that more, or you feel you've got to get over that?
I feel, because I'm a scripted person, and then a lot of the brilliant Irish comedians are very kind of improvisational. Jason, you know, Tommy, Dara. I feel that in order to... I should be kind of looser on stage all the time. So I don't learn... Then I don't end up learning my stuff well enough before I go up there. And, you know, I have this kind of shambolic... approach then, and people and it just doesn't feel finished, and if I was coming to me, I would love to say, Eleanor, will you just write something and learn it before you go up there, and you know, then improvise once you have a structure. But I think I've just totally contradicted what I've said earlier on.
That's fine. We're allowed to contradict ourselves.
Okay.
Yeah, that is interesting. What have you read a piece of a piece of criticism about you that has particularly wounded you? And I only ask because I think the stuff that I worry, and this might be highfalutin, it might be nonsense, but I kind of, my concern is that when I get a bad review or worst, an average review, worse than that, an average review, I suppose I kind of, it affects me emotionally because I think, no, if it affects me emotionally, it's because I worry that those are things I agree with. Do you know what I mean? It's almost like that thing of saying, you know, when you insult someone else, what you are, the people you don't like, it's really things about yourself that they're reflecting.
Okay.
That kind of idea. I'm wondering whether whether you've read a piece of criticism that has hurt particularly, and whether that is because it reflects some sort of truth or some worry that, or maybe not even a true one, but maybe some worry that you have about yourself.
I'm not really, actually. No, if something is true, I kind of actually quite like it, and it's usually something that I actually am grateful to the person. But I do sometimes, I think it's to do with like sometimes I've had reviews that have said she shouldn't be doing comedy. she's not a comedian. You know, there are people.
How do you cope with that?
Well, you just try and bolster
yourself. Off.
Yeah, I can. You're wrong. You know, I suppose part of that is part of not wanting to read reviews is being afraid that other comedians are reading my reviews.
Yes,
and that's part of the conversations that I'm having with people. And part of being a comedian, I suppose, one of the things I really value about it is getting to be friends with so many other comedians, and you know, being able to have the conversations with them. So there's a kind of an instinctual kind of like, if other people have read this, maybe they'll decide I shouldn't be. Maybe I'll lose that affection or something like that from other comedians.
I think that's very well articulated, Emily. Yeah, absolutely.
And that is.
Like, you might get kicked out of the gang.
I might get kicked out of comedy.
Believe you. Oh, no.
Yeah, like they would listen to a reviewer over.
That's insane, isn't it? But yeah. I suppose that's kind of almost what I'm getting at. That's what cuts to the heart of the, you know, that's the fear. That's probably half the reason why so many comics get so angry about reviews is probably there's a kernel of that in it. Yeah, I think that's bang on.
Well, one of the lovely things about being a comedian is that, you know, the green rooms is that we get to kind of be in and you get to, like, when the audiences see those like brilliant personalities on stage, we get to hang out with them backstage and the more honest version, more honest, relaxed, unprepared version of
that
them.
Wants to talk about their children and what motorway they took. Absolutely. There's a sort of a magical feeling to having access to the people that we love, that you see everyone else love, and being one of those yourself. But also, it's funny, isn't it? Because you are someone like that. You are someone who people will see go into the dressing room and go, oh, I wonder what she's like off stage. I wonder what they're... You know, profile is an issue. You know, obviously everyone wants to know what Dara O'Brien's like.
Sure.
But at the same time, it's the same experience of going, I wonder what it's like behind there.
Yeah.
And yeah, no, that's really interesting. I think that there is an element of reviews where I go, God, what if everyone else believes this?
Yeah.
What? Everyone else who knows me and has lived with me and seen me all the time. And do you know what I mean? I don't read anyone else's reviews and go, oh, I'm going to have to change my opinion of them now.
No, of course.
I don't.
Based on some 20-year-old student from, whatever.
Yeah. But it does. It's funny, that emotional kind of resonance. So listen, we've got to wrap up. Thank you for talking to me. I've got one final question for you, which is, what would your advice be to newer comics? You and I have been going for roughly the same amount of time, about 10 years or so. That is, I think, enough time that you could really go, yep, I am definitely a comedian. And I've noticed in the last few years, people sort of approach me and ask me, and maybe it's to do with the podcast, but I think also separately to that, you end up being, like it or not, a position of authority for people who've only been going 2 or 3 years. And part of you is like, bless. And part of you is like, no, that's reasonable. I fucking put the hours in. Yeah. So what would be your advice to...
Excuse me.
I'm leaving that noise in because it's hilarious. Yeah. What would be your advice to a younger comedian, a newer comedian?
Well, I think play the long game. You know, I wouldn't take gigs for money, or just for the money. I would try and don't go for a kind of, you know, easy laughs either, you know. I would, you know, really try and think about doing it in whatever 10, 15, 20 years time, you know, and what you're going to need to be happy doing it.
So thanks to Eleanor, thanks to my co-producer, Nathan Wood, and a special thanks to James J.Q. Quinton, who's been advising me on what mics to buy and how to use them properly. I hope you'll have noticed an increase in sound quality over the last few shows. That's largely down to J.Q. teaching me how to use the equipment that he's told me to buy. So thanks, J.Q., much appreciated. Tom Stade next week just literally opens his mouth and the wisdom starts pouring out. We got, you know, that Gary Delaney moment that we got about halfway through the interview with him when everyone went, whoa. Tom opens with one of them. It's really superb. Fascinating interview. I'm very pleased with that episode. That's all for now. Thanks, Eleanor, for being on the show. And do check her out on YouTube. Go and see her live as and when you can. And I will speak to you next week with Mr. Tom Stade. Bye for now.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.